Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning, and that means my dad is going to call and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And we are going to also talk about some of the origins of some everyday products, some really insane origins of everyday products that we see all the time. Also, there's a bunch of really fun mistakes that TV shows have made over the years, and we'll jump into that. And some hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. So that's all coming up on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected here. All right, every Monday morning we review the new movies with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. So then Eric and I talk box office as well. Let's get the guys in to get this Monday morning movie reviews going. And here is Eric. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, and Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, let's get started here. Did anybody see Into the Ashes?
No.
No. Oh,
okay, well, I'll get to that later. Steve, tell us about Sword of Trust.
Yes. This is a new film by director and co-writer Lynn Shelton. It's about a guy named Mel, who is played by Marc Maron, who is a curmudgeonly pawn shop owner in Alabama, who spends most of his time sort of swindling his customers while trying and failing to get his sort of man-child employee, Nathaniel, who's played by John Bass, to do any work. A lesbian couple comes into the store, played by Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins, and they are trying to sell what they are saying is a Civil War-era sword that Cynthia, who is Jillian Bell, recently inherited from her grandfather. And along with this sword comes documentation that alleges that this sword is proof that the South won the Civil War. And the weird thing is that they're probably like half your audience right now is probably thinking, oh yeah, I've heard about that. No, you did not hear about that. It didn't happen. And that's sort of the point of this film, is that it plays with expectations, it plays with the truth, it plays with conspiracy theories, and when word gets out about this sword into the sort of truther stratosphere, even though the stories are ridiculous, it isn't long before this so-called prover item draws the attention of some conspiracy theorists, as I mentioned, and then these four sort of hapless partners have to join forces in order to sell this sword to local fanatics who believe in it and say it's real, and they're willing to pay a lot of money for this. As with a lot of Lynn Shelton's films, a lot of the dialogue is improvised off like a loose outline of a story, but the story, like I said, the story is very much a comment on the fluid nature of truth today, and it's also a very funny film. It's maybe not one of Lynn Shelton's funniest or best, but I think Marc Maron is actually really terrific in it, and it's his first leading role in a movie, at least. And the two women are very good in it as well. I mean, they're good at just about anything. It can be a little scary at times. There's a truck drive where the four of them are in the back of a truck, and they don't know exactly where they're going to a secret location where they're going to go sell this thing, and we're not exactly sure what's going to happen. But there's a sort of loopy and funny, and it maybe it meanders a little bit, but overall I give it points for at least an original story, which was created or co-written by a guy named Mike O'Brien, who, Nick, you probably know.
Oh, sure.
He used to be on SNL.
AP Bio.
He created AP Bio, which just got a reprieve from death.
Yep.
He also has a really funny part in Booksmart.
Yes, he does.
But anyway, it's original and has a really engaging cast, and I liked it. It opens at the Music Box.
All right, it's at the Music Box.
Yeah.
And how did it go with Marc Maron there?
He was great. He did two Q&As. Joe Swanberg, who produced the movie, moderated. He was terrific. And one of the shows was completely sold out, and he seemed to have a great time. And he watched most of the first screening with the audience sort of secretly and was, like, genuinely, I think, energized by their response to it. So,
that's nice.
Yeah, no, it was terrific.
And Lynn Shelton has directed several episodes of GLOW.
Glow. She did a lot of episodes in the final season of Marin, his show that was on IFC,
right, and she's
done a ton of TV.
She directed Love as well. She directed a bunch of episodes of Love too. And I like her. I like her movies. I want to get out and see this. And I love Mark Maron. It was it was I didn't go out very often this weekend because it was 100 degrees outside. All right, Eric. What did you think, man?
Yeah, I liked it too. I think there's kind of a perfect kind of cross section of a lot of different types of themes and things that we've seen in a number of movies that have come out of the independent circuit recently, and a lot of the festivals that we've gone to. Describing Marc Maron as playing a curmudgeonly character is almost kind of goes with the territory.
It's not out of his wheelhouse,
but he's actually probably less curmudgeonly in this movie than he is, and certainly in Glow and his television show. And I think part of that is that his character is actually not just this sort of this foil for all this ridiculousness that's going on. We know how great Marc Maron can be in just sort of just silent reaction to sort of idiots circling his space. But there's kind of a little bit of a dark undercurrent here, not just with the idea of where we are in this country and where things are going as far as these truthers and things like that are concerned, but also as his written into his character as a former addict. And these sort of monologues and there's this early scene in the movie where his ex-wife comes into the store and they have this sort of confrontation, and it's just the way that the two of them kind of react to each other is really kind of just subtly and beautifully done. And then this monologue that he has in this truck scene that Steve referenced is another terrific moment. There's some really funny stuff in this movie, especially when they get to the moment where they do have to sell the sword. I think the third act goes on a little bit too long, and then it just kind of cuts off and ends pretty quickly. But there's a lot to like in this movie. And it's just further evidence, not only that Michaela Watkins and Jillian Bell are actually going to be in a movie coming out later this summer called Brittany Runs a Marathon that I highly recommend from Sundance this year.
Yeah.
So the two of them are really funny in this movie as well. But just Marc Maron is just a guy he's just one of these guys that you just want to see more of and get an opportunity to do more roles like this because I think he's terrific.
Yeah, he's great, man. He's just great. And it's nice to see Michaela Watkins actually carve out this niche that she has in movies now, because she got screwed over on SNL. She was only on SNL for one season, and it's funny that there are three women who went through SNL without really breaking any new ground, and Michaela Watkins is one of them. Noelle Wells was on for like a season and has proven to be really great, and then why am I blanking on the third
Jenny
one?
Jenny Slate
who on her first episode dropped an F-bomb.
Yep.
On her first episode of SNL, which I think sealed her fate. So these three women, extraordinarily talented, didn't get to be showcased on very well on SNL, and I'm glad to see where their careers have all gone. So that's cool. So Sword of Trust playing at the Music Box. You should check it out. All right, I'll tell you about Into the Ashes. This is on your on-demand system if you choose to watch it. It's your basic revenge movie. Luke Grimes, from True Blood and a bunch of other stuff, plays this guy who has a violent past, and he's trying to get away from it. But his old crew, led by Frank Grillo, everybody, decides that they want to seek revenge on him, or they want him to get back into it, and they kidnap his wife. So they take his wife, and he's confronted by a sheriff in the town, and he either has to completely forget about his past or do what they tell him to do in order to get his wife back. So it's your basic revenge thing, dark, violent past. I want to forget it, but they won't. They keep, every time I get out, they drag me back in, is basically the kind of thing here. It's directed by Aaron Harvey, who is a master of straight to VOD movies. He's directed like 15 straight to VOD movies, lots of them with Bruce Willis. This is a straight to VOD movie. Everybody goes through the motions. It is one of those things where while they were making it, they were like, okay, let's just do a straight to VOD thriller. And it'll be what everybody expects it is. And it covers absolutely no new ground. Everybody seems to be sleepwalking through it. The action sequences have very little energy to them. You don't really care about the characters. This is basically absolutely as by the numbers in ABC as it gets. When you look on your video on demand and you see the title Into Ashes with Frank Grillo and Luke Grimes, I think you know what you're going to get already, and that's exactly what you get. So I do not recommend Into the Ashes. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. Eric, hang on. Steve, hang on.
Yes, hey.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi. We'll take a break. We'll come back after the news, and we got more movies to review. And then Eric and I are going to talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We're going to talk about the crazy origin stories of 30 everyday products. We've got some fantastic, ridiculous TV mistakes from the past, lots of them, like continuity errors and mistakes, and lots of fun picking apart some of the TV shows' mistakes from the past, and 12 hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. That's all on your Monday morning show. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your Monday morning drive. Monday morning also means it's the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday to talk about the new movies, and then Eric and I will talk about box office and his box office report that he writes about every week. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, again, I didn't get to see this one. I really want to. It was 100 degrees. I basically stayed in for most of the weekend. Eric, tell us about The Art of Self-Defense. I'm really excited about this movie.
Okay, well, this is a new film from writer-director Riley Stearns, who did a really overlooked film from a few years ago called Faults with Mary Elizabeth Winstead. People should find that one if they can't, about the cult leaders and deprogramming cult members. But The Art of Self-Defense is a little more lighthearted in its inception. Jesse Eisenberg plays kind of a mild-mannered accountant. Is there any other kind? One night he is going to buy dog food. He walks to the store, and as he's walking back, he is brutally attacked by a group of people on motorcycles. Having realized that there's little he can do to defend himself, he starts looking into alternative ways to prevent that from ever happening again, including buying a gun. But then coming across kind of a local dojo run by Alessandro Nivola, who goes only in the movie as sensei, he joins the class and hopes to learn self-defense techniques that will help him if this ever comes up. But sensei is not just a guru with the fists and whatnot. He has a certain type of philosophy that certainly bleeds into Eisenberg's character's ego, if you will, and he develops a different type of personality. It's a movie that begins to sort of give you the idea of what can happen when the wrong type of people start invading your brain and start, kind of turn the idea of ego and toxic masculinity into something that becomes potentially uncontrollable. But all that, all the time, sort of masked in the way of a Jared Hess movie, if you will, but with the sensibility of a Jodie Hill film. So this film actually goes quite dark at times. There's actually many comparisons you can make this to Fight Club, certainly. But you know, Eisenberg, you know, kind of excels at characters like this. There's a lot of fast dialogue in the film. He's kind of almost playing, kind of almost like an automaton with this character much of the time in his line readings. And it's a movie that if it can hit you in the right way or can hit you in the wrong way. Like, you know, when I say Jared Hess, that's immediately going to turn off a lot of people. But like I said, there's a dark underbelly to this film, and it leads up to a climax that I've seen a couple times now, and I still can't believe that they pulled off. It is just one of the most hilarious climaxes to a movie you're going to see this year. But, you know, it actually sort of breeds, you know, sort of a really greater hate truth that's happening in our society today. And it's a movie that you're going to walk away with not exactly feeling great about where sort of this culture might be going, particularly with young white males who are looking to sort of make a name for themselves and to sort of boost their profile and to basically not take it anymore. We're seeing way too much of that in social media these days and in other, shall we say, political factions. But this is a really it's a challenging movie while being a really funny movie and a dark movie at the same time. Its influences are definitely being worn on its sleeve, but it ultimately it won me over. So I'm recommending The Art of Self-Defense.
Okay. All right. What about you, Steve?
Yeah, no, I actually caught up with this at a Critics Festival. I think it's great, and I think it's kind of funny that Riley Stearns has made two movies now about the dangers of groupthink. And this idea that you get sucked into something like this, and in this case, Jesse Eisenberg's character does it for a number of reasons. Part is that he gets a certain degree of self-worth and confidence, but he also likes that sense of belonging and accomplishment. There's like a ranking system in this thing that he seems to really care about. It's a really sharply observed satire about tribalism, and I think Eric called it toxic masculinity, which it definitely is, but it's almost like hyper masculinity, like these guys that just, that's their whole identity is wrapped up in how much of a man they can be and in how dumb that makes them look in the end. And Eric's not wrong about Eisenberg either. I actually think this is something very different for him. Usually he's playing something very neurotic and high energy, and this guy, whose name is Casey, he's like almost on the spectrum. He's got like a monotone delivery, very deliberate body movement, takes things a little too literally a lot of the times, and is very easily dissuaded from if something doesn't work out in his direction. And we see a lot of that at him at his job and how his attitude towards the people around him change as he gets more and more confident in his karate skills. So, and yeah, that climax, it's the climax, it's the exact climax you want, and you never would guess it would actually happen. It's phenomenal. The movie's worth it just for that. But I think the whole movie is good. And we didn't really talk about Imogen Poots is in this as one of the higher-ranking members of this dojo. And I think maybe the only female, I think, in the group. Is that right? The only one who's sort of in that secret society, yeah. And her frustration with being a part of this and her sort of having to deprogram a lot of her femininity in order to fit in. This film has a lot to say about that, too. I think this is a terrific film.
All right. All right, The Art of Self-Defense is out right now. You should check that out. I'm definitely going to catch up with it at some point. Okay, all right, Steve. This is an aptly time for this movie to be released. Tell us about Armstrong.
Oh, certainly. Yes. Happy anniversary, everybody.
50th anniversary. 50th anniversary of the Apollo. On my Facebook page, I posted the front page of The Onion from that.
Yes.
one of the most genius Onion front pages of all time.
Oh yeah.
So all right, tell us about Armstrong.
So So sometimes, this is a documentary, sometimes with documentaries you just kind of have to let the story unfold and not worry too much about the bells and whistles that you can, in some documentaries you can put in there, because Neil Armstrong's life is its own set of bells and whistles. You don't have to add anything to it. Obviously, a sizable portion of this movie covers the training and the carrying out of the Apollo 11 mission to the moon, during which Armstrong became the first human being to set foot on the moon. And I think he said something memorable. I don't remember what it was, though. I mean, thanks to this, like, an abundance of never-before-seen footage of both his personal life and his journey to space, the film takes a really great time looking at his life before and after that historic mission. I think that's some of the strongest stuff, actually. And some of the footage I think they're saying is never-before-seen is actually in the movie Apollo 11. So, but I think they probably had a race to get this out.
Yeah,
and anyway, but there's a lot of interviews here with his first wife, Janet, who was portrayed in First Man, his two sons, other family members, fellow astronauts, and other people he worked with at NASA. It's very clear this documentary is produced with the full cooperation and approval of those closest to him, which gives us a lot of insight into him. It also a little bit might smooth over some of the rougher parts of his life. He was often categorized as a recluse, when in fact I think he just got really overwhelmed with the media coverage and overall attention he received after the moonwalk. And then a lot of, most importantly, I think a lot of, I assume it's an autobiography, and clips from, there's readings from his autobiography done by Harrison Ford, which adds a great deal of gravitas to the story, and which goes from his childhood in Ohio to all the Gemini and Apollo missions that he was a part of, and he eventually faded back into life in Ohio and lived out the rest of his days with a second wife and a fairly protective grip on his legacy. I think there's a really funny line in here that somebody says, or maybe it's one of his kids says, thank God social media didn't exist at this time,
yep.
Or he never would have survived the attention and scrutiny, especially when he stepped away from the public eye. So
okay.
I think Armstrong...
Steve, hang on.
Sure.
All right, we got that, and we want to find out what Steve and Eric thought of Armstrong, which is the biography, the documentary about Neil Armstrong. So we'll find out about that. We'll talk about more movies. We've got more movies to review, and we'll talk about the box office as well. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. We'll get back to it after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are going to talk about the origins, some crazy origins of some everyday products that we all know about, and some TV continuity and ridiculous sort of TV mistakes exposed. So we'll do that a little bit. Right now, though, we're reviewing the new movies, and we will eventually talk about box office too. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me, and let's get back to it. Before the break, Steve was telling us about the documentary Armstrong. Let's get back to that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, let's continue. Steve, Armstrong.
The only thing I was going to lastly say is just like the portrait this film draws up is of a genuinely nice guy who just wanted to complete a job that was given to him, whether it was landed him in the history books or not. And it's a worthy biography and as good a way as I can think of to celebrate and mark the anniversary. So, and it's playing at Facets.
Facets.
Yeah.
By the way, I do want to mention, I haven't mentioned this on the air.
Right.
The founder of Facets, Miloš Stehek, passed away. And his contribution to the world of film in Chicago is kind of immeasurable. Facets is an amazing place, and during the height of VHS and video rentals, there was not a better place on the planet to get films than at Facets Cinematheque. Well, Facets Multimedia, located Fullerton near Ashland. And I just wanted to mention, Milos was an amazing guy, and what he did for this city in terms of cinema is incredible. And I just wanted to mention that. So it's playing at Facets. Mm-hmm. All right, Eric, what'd you think?
Yeah, I liked it too, and I certainly don't envy this film having to be, sort of piggyback after we've had First Man and Apollo 11 come out, over the last, 9 months, basically. And so I was sort of worried going in that, this was just going to be kind of treading the same water, things that we, we learned a little bit in First Man, footage that we've seen in Apollo 11, a topic in a period of history that I am, borderline obsessed with.
Yeah.
So I had no a lot about this particular period, so I didn't know, how much more I was going to learn about Neil Armstrong. But the fact that, like Steve said, that this movie certainly does have the full cooperation of the family, that it has access to a lot of personal stuff, a lot of personal home movies, some stuff that we, some NASA stuff certainly, but intimate moments with his family. This movie goes into a little bit more about his young daughter, who passed away at a very young age, and that sort of works as kind of an added addendum to First Man and the arc of that movie. So it was really nice to see that. My favorite stuff in the movie is actually the sort of like the first 50 minutes, as we get to know a little bit more, sort of the prelude to everything that's coming up to the Apollo 11 mission. There's a really great sequence in the movie that, which is not an Apollo 11, obviously, but details the Gemini 8 mission that is, it's detailed in First Man. It's the mission where they ended up in this really horrible role,
yeah,
that they had to get out of. And there's actual footage of that in this documentary that is really the most riveting sequence in the movie. Once you get to the Apollo 11 stuff, there's, again, if you've seen Apollo 11, which I think is one of the best movies of the year, you've seen a lot of that stuff. You've sort of been through that a bit, so you're not going to get a lot of new information there. Then you get a little bit more of just at least one certain guy really did not like Buzz Aldrin, which is, again, brought up in First Man quite a bit.
Yeah.
But you get a little bit of a little sense of that, and the guy that actually, probably made sure that Neil Armstrong was the first guy to actually set up on the moon because he didn't like Buzz Aldrin that much.
Right, right.
Yeah, so stuff like the little tidbits like that are really interesting. The idea that he just kind of was so overwhelmed, just kind of walked away from everything once he got back. There's something poignant to that. It seemed like he really did fulfill his own personal mission, which is something, again, people who have not seen First Man really need to go back and see that movie. But again, on this momentous anniversary that we've been living through this entire week, basically, to go see Armstrong and see any of this footage on any kind of giant screen possible, I'd recommend people getting over to Facets and checking this out.
Yeah, it's at Facets right now. By the way, First Man was on HBO, debuted on HBO this weekend. No one saw that movie in the theater, and it was great. It's a great movie, and it's unfortunate that people don't have the opportunity to see it in IMAX, which is the way to see it. But if you got HBO, really a ridiculously underseen and underappreciated movie. Just First Man is fantastic, and also and Armstrong. And you're right, Apollo 11, that documentary is amazing too. Lots of great stuff. There's a Nat Geo documentary that our friend Rod Pyle was a part of. Lots of really great ways to celebrate this 50th anniversary. And so Armstrong playing at Facets right now. Okay. All right. I didn't see The Lion King, and I don't care. It was, again, I will preface this by saying it was 100 degrees out, but I don't even know if it was 65 out. I don't know if I would want to see The Lion King. But Eric, tell us about The Lion King.
Okay. Well, the plot is the exact same thing as you saw in 1994, the animated film that became a phenomenon and has been remained a phenomenon for the past 25 years. This is Jon Favreau, as he did in some respects with The Jungle Book a few years ago, basically redoing the movie with a photorealistic way, and so all the animals and all the creations, they're not animated, but they are completely CGI'd into the frame. People know the story of the Lion King. Simba is born, and his father Mufasa is king. His brother is Scar, who very much wants to have the throne, but Mufasa and Simba stand in his way. So he concocts a plot and a conspiracy that ends up murdering the king and outcasting Simba into the wild, where he befriends Timon and Pumbaa and learns to reinvent himself. When it's discovered he is still alive, comes back to regain the throne, and people know the plot to The Lion King. So there's nothing here that is new as far as the plot is concerned. So the movie begins. Watching this, I mean, for starters, what Favreau did with The Jungle Book a few years ago was him and Disney and all the people that were involved with that were smart enough to not just do a shot-for-shot recreation of that movie.
Yeah, okay? By the way, Eric, The Jungle Book was a real big movie for me as a kid. I don't remember exactly. It may have been the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater. It's either that or Herbie the Love Bug. It's either those are either two. But the Jungle Book was a big part of my childhood, and I went in to the live action version just like with the lowest expectations. Like, do not ruin my childhood, dude. Don't do it. And I really liked the Favreau version of Jungle
it's
Book.
Good.
I was surprised. I think it's a terrific movie. So
yeah, it's good. And another thing that, maybe I'll circle back upon this, that I think benefits The Jungle Book as compared to this Lion King, is that it actually has a human character in it. It's one thing to do something where you're recreating an animated film with human characters that are going to have CGI, creations in it. We saw Beauty and the Beast and that. But to have just the animals themselves, animals and their faces and emoting is not an easy thing to accomplish outside of animation. Robert Zemeckis certainly got a lot of hell for human characters who were too creepy and photorealistic to believe in.
Especially Polar Express. That's the one that he caught the most hell for.
That was sort of the debut of that technology as well.
Right.
And people still give him hell over that.
Yeah.
The Lion King, their faces seem to barely move at all in the film. And so there's, you're just kind of like you're hearing the lines and you're hearing the celebrity voices behind them, but you don't really feel them beyond living flesh and blood characters. So to go back to what I was saying at the beginning of the movie, it's hard to screw that part up because everybody knows the opening to The Lion King. Probably more, all the movies that have ever been created, people remember the first 5 minutes of The Lion King. That's how, that movie is ingrained into our culture. So it's kind of hard to screw that up, but at the same time, I was missing Elton John's voice during the opening of that with The Circle of Life. So, okay. But none of the songs in the movie, none of the moments of the musical numbers, and there's not a lot of them. Lion King is not a gigantic, piece of musical theater. It's got four or five songs in it, I think, the entire way, and none of them here register. None of them really work, and that's really disappointing. I think some of the voice work in the movie is really subpar.
Okay,
I cannot
Eric, hang on.
Okay,
we got to take a break, and we'll jump right back into your thoughts on The Lion King. The live action version of Lion King from Disney is now out. Eric and Steve saw it. I did not, and we'll get more of Eric's thoughts, and then we'll get Steve's review of The Lion King right after we take this break on 720 WGN.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about the origins of some everyday products. We've got some TV mistakes and continuity errors that we can point out, so the next time you watch some of these shows, you can laugh. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we're talking about the movies, as we do every Monday morning. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi, helped me out reviewing all the new movies. And Eric sticks around to talk about his box office report that he writes every week. Before the break, Eric was telling us about The Lion King, and he started to tell us about what he thought of it. Let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, Eric, continue with The Lion King.
Yeah, so, I mean, and this sort of this grand cavalcade of celebrity voice work that they have, you know, up and down this film, I was shocked how bad some of it was. I could not believe, I had completely forgotten that Donald Glover voices the adult Simba in the movie, and his voice work is so flat, so lifeless, and it almost seemed like sometimes that they're editing around him to make the character work, because the character, the adult character Simba, barely registers. And sometimes, but at one point, I thought they got Matthew Broderick back again to voice the character, but no, it was Donald Glover. The look of the creatures in the movie, you know, some of the special effects worked very well, obviously, but like the character of Scar, for example, has a very distinct look in the animated film. It's simplistic. It's just a darker lion, and he looks a little bit more menacing, as animation can be prone to do. And here, it was just like, it seemed like they just took Mufasa and just made it look like Scar was Mufasa, just came out of the shower every time he appeared on screen. It's so distracting, and it doesn't help poor Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is not exactly doing bad voice work, but he's going up against Jeremy Irons.
Well, yeah, Eric, that's one of the greatest voice performances of all time.
It really is.
It's Jeremy Irons in The Lion King.
Villainous, certainly.
Yeah.
And his voice is so distinctive. And again, this brings me back to my point about the humans, because at least humans can give a different type of performance. They can bring something to a character, make a different slant on it. Here, you're just dealing with the voices. So you have to, so Chiwetel's doing a different voice. He's not trying to copy Jeremy Irons, obviously, but it does. The whole character does not have the real sense of menace that he needs to make this work. And frankly, so much of it doesn't work anyway that, you know, everyone in the movie is sort of fighting an uphill battle. Again, the songs don't work. I still remember, I was in the very same theater. It's remodeled now, but it's very same theater back in 1994, and when I saw the animated Lion King for the first time. And the end of that movie, when Simba takes his throne and he does that slow walk and Hans Zimmer's score elevates, I literally got the chills.
Yeah.
In the theater, watching that moment, I think one of the most beautiful moments in it, I've ever seen in an animated film. And in this movie, they do the same thing, and I felt nothing. And it saddened me that I walked out just kind of my shoulders just sagged when they weren't just kind of shrugging the movie off the whole time. This is just it's one of these Jurassic Park moments in history where everyone was so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Ah, I see. All right. Before we get to Steve, I want to bring my producer in, Tom, because Tom, childhood, the movie of his childhood was The Lion King, and it was like, Tom, it was like your favorite movie growing up, right?
Yeah, it was the movie that made me love movies,
which is really important.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have that movie. Everybody, yep. Everybody has that movie. Steve, I don't know what yours is. What's yours?
Oh, good Lord. I'll have to think about that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, because I know Eric's is E.T., right?
Oh, no, mine was definitely at a much younger age than that would have been.
Mine was Halloween.
I was going to say, maybe it's I Spit on Your Grave. I don't know. No, but the movie, I you know, it probably was like Evil Dead. I think that was the one that made me, I take that back about, I mean, it's like, yeah, that's the one that's made me go, I want to know how this was made.
Yeah.
I don't just want to see it again. I want to know how it was done.
Okay. All right, so that's how you felt. So Lion King, big movie for you, Tom.
Yeah,
And you saw the new version.
I did, and I actually made, maybe it was a mistake, I watched the original, because I own it in, like, every format, but I watched my Blu-ray copy just to remind myself about how, you know, it was like, maybe, how did I feel about this? Sometimes I have to just revisit it every once in a while. And it was like feeling like a child again, and the colors were amazing, and the performances were incredible, and it was just as good as it was back when I first saw it, probably on home video in like 1997, like 1996, 1997. And this new version is technically spectacular. Clearly, people spent thousands and thousands of hours looking at how these animals would move in real life and how they would look. And it's beautiful in that respect, but everything else is just super lame, to put it in basic terms. I think Eric really hit the nail on the head. The performances are flat and mostly uninspired. I don't think Seth Rogen has ever been more annoying in anything, really. And even Billy Eichner, who should have been a slam dunk as Timon, was like, this is fine. And there's nothing stranger than listening to Beyonce do vocal runs on Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Meanwhile, this lion is really not expressing any emotion in this amazing love song from Elton John. So, yeah, it's a disappointment through and through. It's kind of a cynical reminder of what Disney's doing to its own brand.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they've been rehashing their own stuff for a really long time. It's just never felt this obvious or this poorly executed.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. From one of the biggest fans of The Lion King ever. All right. Steve, what did you think?
Well, watching the original again was your first mistake, Tom. But no, I mean, okay, let me begin by saying not a fan of this, not recommending it. I'm going to counter a couple points that have been made and then back up a couple others. Like Tom said, the photorealistic aspect of this, from a purely technical standpoint, is above and beyond just about anything I've ever seen. Like, the realism of these animals and the landscapes is undeniable, but it's also part of the film's deeper problem, because you're sort of stripping away what makes this story magical and what makes hand-drawn animation so magical. The sense of wonder and amazement that people could draw this and bring animals to life like this, which we see all the time in animated films, but in this film it just really felt special because a lot of these animals we'd never seen in movies before. And so basically artistry in this case has been replaced by technical wizardry, which I admit is a form of art, yes. But instead of enhancing the final product, it kind of detracts from it. And for a film whose primary goal is lifelike creations, things here really do feel pretty lifeless at times. So, ironically. I will say I'm not going to dump on all the voice actors. I actually really thought, I mean, and thank goodness they were here. The times when this movie strays even a little bit from the original made me the happiest. And I think most of the stuff with Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner is not the same dialogue that they have given us before, that these characters have given us before. I thought they were pretty funny. And you can clearly tell they're improvising and just saying, like, just things are just popping out that like, it don't make any sense, and they're really funny. I actually did think Chiwetel Ejiofor was kind of mesmerizing, in part because he's not trying to copy Jeremy Irons. I think it's a delivery that kind of drips with sarcasm and bitterness, and this is maybe even more so than Jeremy Irons' performance. This time I actually felt like this guy, as bad as he is, this character Scar, as bad as he is, he really is just doing this because he feels slighted. He feels like he was sort of passed over, and we kind of get, I think, a little bit more of a sense of that. It's not an entirely different performance, but at least he's not like aping what was done before. I honestly think this is probably, using these techniques, I think this is the best version of The Lion King that Favreau could have made. That doesn't mean it should have been done, like Eric said. This should not, maybe shouldn't have been done at all. And I'm not one of those people that automatically thinks a remake is a bad thing. I think that in general with these Disney things, that the more they stray from the original, like Jungle Book does at points, the better they are. And if someone says to me, "What about Dumbo?" I'll punch you in the face because that is not a remake. It's a war wound of a film, but it's not a remake. I'm not sure much could have been done to save The Lion King from feeling soulless and pointless, but the movie illustrates that the closer you move into the real world in these kind of films, the further you get away from the beauty of the make-believe. So,
all right, there you go. Okay, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
We got one more movie to review, and we will get to that after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here on 303 Wacker, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m., and we're reviewing the new movies. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke and lots more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to talk about movies, and then Eric sticks around and we talk about his box office report and the numbers for the weekend. Let's bring these guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. Steve, tell us about The Farewell.
Ah, now there's no better place we could go after The Lion King.
Yeah, I know. That's why I planned it that way, Steve. So.
Certainly one of the most talked about and critically acclaimed films that was at Sundance this year, as well as a sold-out show at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, was writer-director Lulu Wang's second feature, The Farewell, starring Awkwafina in her first lead role. Based on an incident in Lulu Wang's own family, in fact, the movie even opens with a title card that says based on an actual lie, which will make sense in a second. The Farewell concerns a Chinese family who discovers that the matriarch named Nai Nai, played by the really great veteran Chinese actress Zhao Shuzhen, that she has terminal lung cancer and only a few months left to live. In keeping with Chinese tradition, her family opts not to tell her of the seriousness of her illness, and instead arranges to have most of the extended family members fly in some cases from all over the world, to sort of say their goodbyes under the guise of a rushed wedding of one of her grandchildren. And Awkwafina plays Billy, who's a granddaughter, not the one who's getting married, but who moved to New York with her parents, played by Diane Lynn and the great Zima, when she was very young, and she thinks keeping the truth from her grandmother is a mistake. So everyone suggests maybe she'd not come on the trip lest she sort of spill the beans on this big secret. But she does come against their wishes. And the film sort of follows Billy's journey back to the land of her birth, where she can either toe the family line or bring her sort of modern Western sensibilities to the situation. It's a remarkable, very funny, always highly emotional work that is probably going to make a lot of best of the year lists this year. It certainly will be one of mine, I think. And an Awkwafina's dramatic turn here is a huge accomplishment and really does prove that she can carry a film without a doubt. The film provides a great deal of insight also into what it must be like for someone moving to another country where you don't know anyone and to start a new life. There are no bad guys in this story, which I also really loved. Just family members with sort of differing ideas on how to handle the situation with this illness and whether or not to let her know. And Billy is not the only one who thinks that maybe they should tell her. It's a warm, immersive, inviting, it feels like a big hug of a movie. And although this is dealing with a Chinese family, it really could be any family from any place in the world that has strong beliefs and traditions that may not sync up with the way a lot of the world might think about something. Look at it as a learning experience with some amazing food on display and just joyousness and this really essential performance, I think, at the center. There's sort of a heartbreaking farewell sequence at the end where the family member, not when anybody dies, but I'm saying when the family leaves China and goes back to America, tears are going to flow. But there's a really sort of uplifting feeling to the entire piece thanks to a parting title card just before the end credits. I won't ruin that. And by the end, it all feels like home to us. And I know that I miss this place and miss these characters already. So I went and actually just saw the film again today just to sort of remind myself what I thought of it. And I still think it's one of the best films of the year.
Okay. All right, Eric.
Yeah, I adore this movie ever since I saw it at Sundance. I did want to really quickly correct something, not just Steve, but also myself. And many times I've talked about this film before. The director's name is actually Lulu Wong, just so we have that going forward. But, yeah, I mean, this is a movie that, you know, there are a lot of movies that we've seen that are about grief and loss and family and things like that. But I think this is one of the best movies I've ever seen about avoiding grief, and you know the way that grief, you know, is its own sort of cancer that you know can brew up inside of you, and you can let it out. You can deal with it in your own way, and you know that's exactly what's going on in this movie with this family, and you know whether or not it's a cultural item that you agree with, as being an American is concerned. I think it makes for sort of an interesting discussion. Anyone who's had to deal with any kind of loss in their life, what is the proper way to deal with it? You know, would someone have lived longer if you know they didn't have the burden, which is basically what the Chinese culture preaches, that you know someone you know diagnosed with such an illness, if they know they're going to die, does that affect them in such a way that it just speeds up the illness? And I think that that's an interesting thing to talk about, whether you agree with it or not. But this movie is just, this movie has a livelihood. This movie, while this movie is about an impending death, it's so very much alive. Awkwafina, who is about ready to just sort of blow up in film, basically, she's being cast in everything right now. I don't know when we're going to see a better performance from her than we see in this movie, because she's been in a few things that we've seen. She's hosted SNL, certainly, so she's definitely out there. But her work in this movie, I think it's one of the best performances of the year, and everyone is so good in this movie. It's one of the movies that's going to make you cry multiple times throughout. Different things, again, depending on your own personal experience, where you're at, as confronting, and again, I also think this is one of the better movies that I've seen about that kind of personal relationship between a grandparent and a grandchild and things like that. I think that the relationship between the two of them is really special, and considering that throughout the whole movie they're coming at it from completely two different perspectives, it brings an extra level of pain and humanity to it all. But as Steve said, this is a movie that is definitely going to make people cry and going to create a lot of hugs for family members by the time it's all over. But I promise everyone who goes to see it, they will leave with a great big smile on their face at the end of this movie. This is a movie that I think is going to blow up the rest of the summer.
I agree with you. It's one of the best movies of the year. It is. It's absolutely amazing. And every performance in this movie is stunning. But man, Awkwafina, you know, and I've been a fan of hers, you know, kind of since the beginning. I liked her in Ocean's 8. I think mm-hmm. she's really, you know, like her music career is really kind of fun, and I thought she was terrific on SNL. But this is just wow. I mean, where did that come from? She's so great in this movie, and the thing that I loved most about it is that I learned something. You know, like this is a cultural mm-hmm. about this culture, and I found it fascinating and really interesting, and you know. I just wanted to mention, you know, Crazy Rich Asians from last year, which was a very entertaining movie, made a ton of money, really blew up, but it seemed a lot more westernized, if you know what I mean, than this film. This is a movie that was like we're gonna show you what it's like in this culture, but we are not gonna make it Western. You know what I mean? This is a movie where if you're from the West, you're an American or whatever, and you see this movie, it's not going to be sort of like your generic sort of rom-com, which Crazy Rich Asians was, as good as it was. You know what I mean? But there's something deeper and more significant about this movie. It is. I cried like a maniac during this movie. I mean, I think people wanted to call EMTs at one point. I got invested into these characters, and I never had a grandfather. Both my parents' fathers passed away before I was born, and I only had one grandmother till I was 10, and another till I was 18. So I never had the opportunity to be an adult with a grandmother. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So to see this kind of thing, that also destroyed me during the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so people are going to blink. Like both of you guys said, Eric, especially you said you're going to bring your own personal, you know, baggage to this movie. Because mm-hmm. everybody has dealt with this kind of stuff before. Everybody deals with grief. Everybody deals with disease. And how the family deals with it is an incredibly complicated thing. And it's an incredibly complicated thing in this movie. But the casting in this movie, it's beautifully written. It's beautifully directed. Every single emotion is covered in this movie. It's a joyous experience. I adore this movie. I absolutely adore it. I agree with you guys completely. It's absolutely one of the best movies of the year. It's only playing in 3 theaters now, but it's going to open wide. And like you, I agree with you, Eric. This thing is going to blow up. I think it's going to be really, really big.
So. Yeah, it's actually. I think it's going to expand a little bit wider next week, and then on August 2nd, it's supposed to go a bit more nationwide.
Okay. All right. So we got Tarantino's movie next week, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Steve, thanks, buddy.
Yes. Thanks.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. And yep. Eric, you hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, we got to take a break for the news here. And when we come back, we'll talk box office with Eric Childress right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We're going to talk about some pretty insane origin stories of everyday products. We got some hidden treasures that are actually worth nothing. And we're going to talk about some TV show errors that you can spot. And right now we've reviewed all the new movies. The one to see, as we mentioned before the news, is The Farewell with Awkwafina. It is really one of the very best movies of the year. But every week we do talk box office. Eric writes a box office report. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. The Lion King, $185 million. If I'm not mistaken, the people who were making the predictions were right on.
Yeah, this is one of the rare occasions in some time where they really kind of just hit the nail on the head. They said about $185 million throughout the whole weekend. There was, you know, talk that it might get up to 200, maybe over 200 plus. That it was like maybe somewhere between 192 and 200, and ultimately fell back on $185 million. And it's made over $534 million worldwide.
Yeah.
in 10 days of release. It opened in China last week. So it's only 3 days of domestic, 10 days of worldwide, and it's already $534 million.
That's insane. Wow.
Yep.
That's crazy. Not surprising, though. Not really surprising.
Nope, not at all.
Before we get to the rest of the top 10, some big box office news in terms of Endgame.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it was, Kevin, the San Diego Comic-Con has been going on this past week,
right.
And the big Marvel presentation was Saturday night, and even though the final numbers were not in for the weekend, Kevin Feige, took the stage and proudly announced that Avengers Endgame had overtaken Avatar as the highest-grossing film ever worldwide.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, and thankfully the reports are that they sort of found some extra money from overseas. So I don't know exactly where they quote unquote found some extra money, but they did.
Yeah,
So that sort of closed the gap a little quicker than people were expecting. The movie was about $7 million away going into the weekend.
Yeah,
and by Saturday night they were proclaiming victory, and by the end of Sunday, as far as the reports are concerned, it has passed Avatar.
Yeah, well, they had to make the announcement. You know that,
right?
They had to at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
You can't pass up that opportunity.
Exactly.
So all right, well, there it is. Avengers Endgame, biggest movie ever made.
Yep,
which is really insane.
When you think about it, Nick, I mean, if you look at the history of the box office, since 1975, it's been Spielberg, Lucas, Cameron, and the Russo brothers have all owned the top grossing film of all time.
The Russo brothers. All right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Okay, well, let's get back to the top 10. Speaking of Marvel. It just doesn't stop, does it?
No.
Spider-Man Far From Home, $21 million. It's up to $319 million domestically.
Yeah, it's going to make a run at $400 million. It's on pace for that right now. I think the Tarantino movies. I mean, it's not going to cut into that so much. It's going to have pretty much all of August to stay in the top 10. So it's already $889 million worldwide. So this thing's headed for $1 billion as well.
Insane. Insane.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, Toy Story 4. Boy, everything is Disney in the top. It's all Disney in the top three.
Yeah.
$14.6 million, $375 million domestically.
Yeah, remember a couple weeks ago, Toy Story 4, what a disappointment
yeah.
it made when it only made like $120 million when
yeah.
it opened?
Yeah.
Yeah, $370-some million in domestic. It's probably going to finish somewhere around around 415, 420, again, over $850 million worldwide. That's headed for $1 billion as well.
Yeah, God. Is Crawl headed for $1 billion?
It is not. It is not.
$6 million.
But it is comfortably headed for somewhere between like $35 and $38 million, which, adding a couple extra bucks overseas, has made about almost another $10 million internationally right now. And so it's about a $16 million production, something like that.
Yeah.
It's going to be in profit.
Okay, good.
Your alligator movie is going to be successful.
Very cool. All right. Number five, Yesterday. What a success story this is. $5 million, $58 million about right now. And this has turned out to be a great hit for Danny Boyle.
Yeah, this is a movie that, until the movie that we've just been talking about, I think is the movie that adults have been sort of headed out. All the spectacles and Disney and Marvel stuff that's come out, this is the one that sort of sparked, like, oh, let's go see something that's about people and music and stuff. And this movie, it looks like it's probably going to be headed somewhere over $70 million, which is a real success.
Okay. And then Stuber, $4 million, $16 million in 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, this movie is pretty much on the same trajectory that Midsommar is on. Both of those movies are probably going to finish up somewhere around $25 million.
Yeah.
So, and Stuber cost like $26 million, I think.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a failure.
Aladdin, good lord. 3.8. Let's get back to Disney, everybody. 3.8
yep.
million, $340 million total. Bigger than anybody expected, or at least you and I.
Yeah, certainly, and the movie just kept going. Like, I thought it would open well and then maybe die off pretty quickly, but no, it's maintained its pace, and it is $12 million shy of $1 billion. Yeah, and also Disney now with Lion King, which is now had the ninth highest opening of all time with $185 million. Disney, 12 of the top 13 opening weekends are owned by Disney.
That's unbelievable! Wow.
Yeah.
Number eight, Annabelle Comes Home, $2.6 million, $22.4 million total. How's that compared to the other
Less than the other ones. The other ones finished around between like 250 and 300 million worldwide. This one is just about a 200 million worldwide. Again, small budgeted film. This is a pretty major success.
Okay, Midsommar, 1.5 million. 18 million total.
Yeah.
In 3 weeks.
Yeah, we this is the movie that we all wish was doing better, but it never had a chance.
No, it didn't.
With subject matter and audiences, you know, clearly not buying it.
Yeah, yeah. And then number 10, Secret Life of Pets 2, clinging in there into the top 10, 1.5 million, 151 million, a real big drop, as we've talked about, from the first one.
Like 600 million drop.
Jeez.
From the first one. I have to go back and do some research to see if there's ever been a sequel drop that far on the scale. I don't know if there has been.
No. All right. Well, what are we looking at next week? Lion King still number one, correct?
Lion King will still be number one, yeah. I mean, I think that'll probably drop to probably maybe around 75 to 85 million, maybe something like that. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood should be a pretty solid second, probably in the 30s, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's been pretty well advertised. Maybe they could get that thing over 40. I'm not sure what the extension of Farewell is going to be next week. I think it's getting a little bit of a bigger release. So maybe that can sneak into the top 10 next week.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the top 10 this week, but it was only in 35 theaters.
Yeah,
made $1.17 million, which is
right
along the lines of The Kids Are All Right and Lady Bird and the Boyhood made in their second weekend, and those movies all went out to have a pretty solid box office for independent movies. And like you, I think the Farewell, once this thing expands, I think this movie is going to play like gangbusters the rest of the summer.
I totally agree with you, man. And by the way, we didn't mention what theaters it's playing in Chicago, and you should definitely make the trip.
See. And it's a PG movie too, people.
Yeah, exactly. It's PG. It's a wonderful movie. Really, really, really wonderful. One of the truly, truly one of the best movies of the year. It's at the AMC River East downtown. It's at the Landmark Century Cinema on Clark and Diversey, and it's at the Century 12 in Evanston. Make that trip to see. It's a very special movie. A very,
definitely,
very special movie. So you're thinking about 30 million or so for Tarantino. What's Tarantino's biggest opening?
Was it Django or Inglourious Bastards?
I think it's Inglourious. My guess would be
Inglourious
Bastards, because Brad Pitt's in it. So that would have been my guess. But you got DiCaprio and Pitt in this one.
It could be big, but it's a long movie. It's an R-rated film. We'll see. Hateful Eight didn't do great.
Yeah, it didn't.
Remember, so we'll see exactly if people show up for this. The hype has been there. The reviews are certainly very good for it. I think that we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I'm are you there, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you got cut off. I also want to remind people that obviously it's going to be opening in wide. It's got a big wide release, right? Hollywood.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but it is playing in 70mm at the Music Box starting on Thursday.
That's correct.
If anybody wants to check it out in 70, I know my producer Tom's going on Thursday to check it out in 70. If you want to see it in 70mm at the beautiful Music Box Theater, 70mm in all its glory, which, by the way, I did go to the Roadshow back in 2015 when Hateful Eight opened, and I saw it at the Music Box with the intermission. And
me too.
With the program. One of my favorite cinematic experiences ever, and I'm not kidding. I just thought I thought it was amazing, all of that. So experience it in 70mm at the beautiful Music Box Theater starting on Thursday, and it'll open wide on Friday, and then we'll find out exactly how much it will make. What else is coming out? What else is coming out next week?
That's the only major release next week.
Okay. Well, that's okay. And so that's why Lion King will still be number one.
Exactly.
Nothing going on. And then beginning of August, we've got the Hobbs and Nobbs. What the hell is
Hobbs and Nobbs?
Yeah. Is that going to be number one when it comes out?
Yes.
Yeah, I would think
by
so.
The time that comes out, it'll knock Lion King off the throne.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Fast and Furious presents.
That's right.
Ridiculous. I'll probably end up loving it.
Probably.
Yeah. All right, Eric, thanks, man. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
There you go. Eric Childress, everybody. You can read his box office reports, and you can hear him here with Steve Procopi reviewing all the new movies, as we do every week. Okay, we're going to take a break right here on 720 WGN.